Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the extraordinary presidential powers to assassinate that are represented by the drone program and are at issue with the confirmation of John Brennan to head up the CIA. Bruce Fein, a constitutional lawyer who was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Reagan administration and helped write the articles of impeachment for both President Nixon and President Clinton, joins us to discuss the kill list and the unchecked powers of the president. Then we'll look into the efforts to block Chuck Hagel's nomination as Secretary of Defense and the incendiary but baseless accusations made by freshman Senator Ted Cruz that Hagel received money from North Korea and that the Iranian government is celebrating his nomination. Matt Angle, who directs the Lone Star Project and was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus, joins us to discuss the reincarnation of Senator Joseph McCarthy in Texas's junior Senator Ted Cruz and whether the nastiness of this Tea Party bomb thrower represents the future of Texas politics. Then finally, we'll examine the prosecutorial loophole that the renewal of the Violence Against Women Act seeks to close, which has 22 Republican senators and a majority of House Republicans siding with the abusers of women as they defend the status quo that allows non-Native Americans to rape and even murder Native American women on tribal land and get off scot-free. Sarah Deer, an expert on violence against Native women, where 80% of the rapes reported by Native women on tribal lands are perpetrated by outsiders, joins us. She's the author of Garden of Truth, The Prostitution and Sex Trafficking of Native Women in Minnesota. And joining us now is Bruce Fein, who is a constitutional lawyer and he served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, and a Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has written several books on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for both President Nixon and President Clinton. He's the author of American Empire Before the Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein. Again, Bruce Fein is a constitutional lawyer who served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has written several books on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for both President Nixon and President Clinton. He is the author of American Empire Before the Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein.
Thank you so much, Ian.
So, Bruce, this is a live program, so I don't know what happened, but we're so grateful that you were able to finally join us so I can finally get started here today. Of course, much is made about the drone program, and in many ways, a more accurate way to look at it is an assassination program. And 3,000 people have been killed so far since 9/11 by these means. So the president, in his State of the Union, talked about some more transparency in the program. And also, on Friday, the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is considering John Brennan's nomination, got a letter from him saying, in which he vowed to, if he's confirmed, that he would work closely with the Defense Department to ensure there is no unnecessary redundancy in capability and missions. There you have a possible shift, in as much as the drone program may be shifted away from the CIA into the Defense Department. And then you've got the president in the State of Union Tuesday saying that he wants to be even more transparent about the targeting, detention, and prosecution of terrorists. Does any of that give you any comfort?
No, and let me give a little bit of background for your audience, Ian. The Declaration of Independence, sort of the starting point for thinking about the final end of the state and our rights as citizens of the United States. And it says that we are, because of we're just born as individuals, we're entitled to the protections of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The latter meant virtue and wisdom at that time, not hedonism. But putting that aside, we don't have to justify our right to life and liberty without, you know, with except when due process of law establishes that we've committed some wrong against society. That is inherent in being born. And what we have with the drone program, but it really, drone is just the method at present by which the president extinguishes someone's life. The precedent, the legal theory is that the president in secret can serve as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner to target anyone, including an American citizen, anywhere on the planet for death based upon his unilateral determination that the target is an imminent threat to the United States. And imminent doesn't mean it will happen very soon. It means that it might happen at any time that the president decides it might be a danger, which could be 5 years or more. For example, when Mr. Alaki was vaporized, destroyed by a predator drone walking in Yemen, he clearly was not someone at that time who was engaged in any active hostilities against the United States, and there was no attempt to capture Mr. Alaki. Now, people say, well, you shouldn't require American soldiers, you know, to endanger their lives when they're trying to kill the enemy. But if the standard is that no one in the armed forces should have to have their lives at risk or limbs at risk in executing their functions, we might as well start dropping nuclear bombs against any country, any people we dislike, and say, hey, we don't want to risk our soldiers, so let's just incinerate everybody who's there. It doesn't really matter whether they're innocent or not, because it's just our say-so that at some future time they could be dangerous to the United States. And if we think throughout the course of history, if we take the history of tyranny, it is impossible to identify any other figure. You could go back to Genghis Khan, you could go back to Ivan the Terrible, you can go back to the Ottoman Sultans, and no one has ever claimed authority to take the life of anyone on the planet based upon a secret determination by one individual that that person is a danger. It's truly an astonishing usurpation and claim of authority. Even God was reluctant to kill everyone before Noah had his ark, that he left Noah alive, I suppose, but our president now claims authority to even exceed that pre-Diluvian days of the Old Testament. And what is equally astounding is that the Congress and the American people seem rather complacent with this authority, in large measure, I believe, because its victims are mostly people whose names sound Arabic or Muslim and not American yet, and therefore there's very little protest. It's not dissimilar to what happened during World War II when President Roosevelt put in concentration camps 120,000 loyal Japanese-American citizens and inhabitants of the United States without a crumb of evidence that any of them had ever committed espionage, sabotage, or were disloyal. And we have that same fact. And at that time, there was virtually no protest either in the United States, even from the American Civil Liberties Union and liberal groups. And at present, even though the danger is far less than World War II, there is a belief, I think, of most Americans, I'm not going to be targeted, therefore, why should I worry? Well, one, just as a matter of dignity, is it really satisfactory for you to wake up and know that your life depends upon the indulgence of the president? You know, you've been reduced to vassalage or serfdom, and you don't have any right to live. It's just an indulgence of your government. And that, to me, is rather terrifying. And the second thing to think about is that even if Obama does not take this terrible authority and use it against Americans in the United States, the legal precedent will lie around like a loaded weapon for any Caligula who happens to enter the Oval Office and decide, well, maybe Obama didn't, but I will, because there isn't anything in theory that prevents the president right now from exterminating you or me or anyone in the audience. And if he says we really were not a danger, well, but in wartime you sometimes make errors. I mean, I hardly have words to describe how someone like me, whose baptism was Washington, was Watergate, and when that president, Richard Nixon, said if the president doesn't, it's legal, that provoked an outcry amongst Americans and a successful effort to drive him from office, first through impeachment articles and before the trial that he knew he would be convicted in the Senate. And now, and what was Nixon's claim was he could burglarize the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg and obstruct justice, not kill people. Now we have a president says he can kill people, and there's no response whatsoever. Truly dismaying. And lastly, if we go back and examine the articles of indictment against King George III that were penned in the Declaration of Independence, we justified a revolution because we were denied rights at jury trial, and we were taxed without representation. There's nothing in our Declaration that at all accuses King George III of extinguishing the lives of all Americans without any process whatsoever. We protested the lack of a jury trial, but our current president doesn't give anyone a trial whatsoever. And so if we use the Declaration of Independence as a benchmark, it shows how tyrannical our own government has become, more so than King George III's.
So, again, I'm speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration and helped write the articles of impeachment for both President Nixon and President Clinton, and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall. But, of course, Obama is in many ways following his predecessor, George W. Bush. And what's interesting is that the Supreme Court did curtail President Bush's powers under the Hamdi case. The only dissent came from Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, who supported the Bush administration's theory of executive power, saying that due process requires nothing more than a good faith executive determination. The dissent was written by Sandra Day O'Connor, who remind us of the court's decade-long admonition, a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the right of the nation's citizens. So, of course, we don't have Sandra Day O'Connor on the court anymore. What is your sense of how long the president can hold off the courts on this issue?
Well, I do not believe that the courts can be trusted to save the republic. It's the American people in Congress who need to react. The courts are too slow. The Hamdi decision that you identified, Hamdi against Rumsfeld, was a decision that simply said you had, with regard to habeas corpus and detainees at Guantanamo Bay who hadn't been killed, that they had a right to at least some kind of hearing. And even there, in the aftermath of Hamdi, the hearing is largely cosmetic because the government relies upon classified secret evidence to say someone's an enemy combatant. And if you don't know what the accusation against you is, it's very hard to respond. That's self-evident. And subsequently, they decided another Hamdan case in Boumediene that provided at least a little bit of greater habeas corpus protection to have your claim that you're not an enemy combatant adjudicated in a federal court. But those have not addressed the issue of killings. And indeed, when there was an effort after Mr. Awlaki was assassinated in Yemen to bring his lawsuit claiming wrongful death, the court threw it out saying it's state secrets privilege in order to question the standards by which President Obama decided to murder Mr. Awlaki. If we would disclose state secrets, therefore the case is thrown out. I mean, it's that kind of, I don't know whether I'd call it Kafkaesque, Orwellian, Alice in Wonderland reasoning. Let's see. If you identify why someone murdered you, disclose a state secret so you lose? Wow. That's something that I used to read about in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Critique of the Soviet Union. I never expected it to be written by a federal court. And there's an effort even most recently by the ACLU to obtain the written analysis in the Justice Department of the theory behind president's claim that he can kill everyone on the planet in secret, and that failed as well. The courts are inclined, Ian, in times of conflict, to be excessively deferential to the executive branch. They're frightened of national security. I remember in World War II, I spoke about the concentration camps. The two cases went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, ordinarily racial distinctions are odious to a free people, but we're fighting, so don't come to the courts for any kind of redress. It's really up to Congress and us to insist that these are impeachable offenses. And I agree with you, Obama's not the first. Bush, Cheney were equally culpable in flouting the Constitution under the banner of national security. And it isn't just Bush, Cheney. It traces back probably 50 or 60 years in terms of a trajectory of ever-increasing executive claims of authority to do whatever they want in the name of national security. Now, we did have a little bit of what you might call a counter-revolution in that trend in the aftermath of the Nixon impeachment, and you may recall the Pike and the Church Committee hearings, where the Americans at that time were appalled that the CIA was attempting to assassinate Castro and Lumumba and Trujillo and others. And that was when President Ford issued an executive order prohibiting assassinations. And now we see it on a grander scale, and people just yawn and say, oh, well, so what? After all, we're empire, we're big, we're the leader of the world, we get to do whatever we want. There's another element that comes into play here, too, Ian, and this is the one that afflicts all empires, and that is failing to recognize, you know, we're not going to have a monopoly on predator drones. There's going to be a time when Russia and China and others get them. And what's going to happen when they decide they'll send predator drones into the United States saying, oh, well, we're trying to kill an enemy combatant, someone who's opposed to our regime, whether it be in Beijing or Moscow or elsewhere, so that we may soon be seeing the double-edged sword that we have set into play with our own use of predator drones, which we argue can be used anywhere in the world that we want on our say-so alone.
Well, Bruce Fine, obviously the executive order against assassinations that was put forth by and signed by President Ford after the Church and Pike committees is absolutely useless now, even though apparently it still binds CIA officers. It doesn't bind the president. And I'm curious to know about the mechanics of this kill list, which is generated, I believe, by the counterterrorism centers and by the military and the CIA. And then eventually it gets up to the National Security Council. And then eventually the president has to sign off on who they decide to zap. And my understanding is that this is not a particularly foolproof procedure. There are a lot of analytics done, with computer analytics where programs sort of, collate all of the activities of somebody and then they gradually move from green to amber to red.
It's lovely. It's like graduation, you know. Yeah. You have to move from one level to another. It'd be humorous, except it's so grisly and ugly. Listen, these are the same experts at intelligence gathering that informed us that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. These are the same experts who predicted Gorbachev would just be like Stalin and Lenin and Khrushchev and others. They did not at all understand perestroika. These are those who couldn't get it right when, India exploded a test a nuclear weapon. So, and we're relying upon these people to hold the authority of life and death over anyone in the world. And now they've moved to what they call signature strikes, whereby they don't even know the identity of the person they've targeted for killing. They just say, well, they assume that any adult male who's in 50 or 100 yards of someone they think is al-Qaeda must be a sympathizer, because al-Qaeda is so paranoid they wouldn't let anyone come within 50 or 100 yards unless they were an associate or colleague. So, and of course there's no post-mortem. Ian, to actually after the fact to say, hey, was this person really a so-called hostile enemy of the United States, or were they like Mr. Alaki's 16-year-old teenage son and U.S. citizen who was vaporized and now disappeared from discourse because president doesn't want to think that he killed somebody who was a child of a father and mother, just like his kid sitting in the White House, and he didn't give him due process, and I can guarantee the 16-year-old was not holding a gun or anything else when he was exterminated. So when we look at the overall effort of the president here to pick and choose, life and death for anybody in the planet, it's a grisly business. And it's going on right in the Oval Office. I mean, going back to Watergate, I remember I was horrified to think, since I've been in the Attorney General's office many times, to think John Mitchell was plotting, with the Gordon Liddy and others, the break-in of the Democratic National Committee in Watergate. He said, "You mean you're plotting crimes in the Attorney General's office?" But I think now we're at the level. It's at the Oval Office. It's the White House. President individually, you know, it's like Henry II and who will rid me of this turbulent priest and Becket gets extinguished. That's what we want our president spending his time doing. And then putting aside even all that that horror, what is the so-called strategy behind it? Where's the success? I mean, how many times have we killed the number two of Al-Qaeda? Like 38, 40 every day? Oh, it's a militant number two. It must be the most dangerous job on the planet. They must have give a lot of life insurance for anyone who's willing to accept a promotion. Well, I don't know whether there actually is promotion like that, other than that in the minds of the CIA. But that's another strike against the whole exercise. Where are the great successes in terms of strategy? Where is it bringing us? You know? And other than risking retaliation and making people hateful towards the United States because we're killing innocent civilians. The president just sort of goes on by its own authority. And now it's become, in some sense, institutionalized with Leon Panetta, the former secretary of, I guess, he's former secretary of defense. Hagel hasn't been voted on yet. Said, now we've had a new medal that we award to those who aren't on the battlefield, don't fly any planes, but they press the buttons in Nevada or Utah to vaporize people with predator drones. You know, that's heroism. Wow. That shows how far we've plunged as a country, Leon.
Well, Bruce Vine, I thank you so much for joining us. And I guess when you say that the American people have to make this change, 80%+ of them are in favor of the drone program. So clearly we've got a long way to go. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan Administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He's written several books on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for both President Nixon and President Clinton. He's the author of American Empire Before the Fall. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the nastiness of the Tea Party bomb thrower from Texas, the junior Senator Ted Cruz.
There's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great skill. Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matt Angle, who directs the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at state and national levels. He has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Angle.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Matt. And I just couldn't believe what I was hearing, watching the Foreign Armed Services Committee of the Senate debating the nomination of Chuck Hagel to be the next Secretary of Defense, with the baseless accusations from the freshman senator of Texas, Ted Cruz, arguing that Hagel received money from North Korea and that the Iranian government is celebrating his nomination. A lot of people are seeing both a political and an almost a physical a similarity that the young senator has with Senator Joseph McCarthy. So does this, the nastiness of this Tea Party bomb thrower, is that the future of Texas politics?
Well, it certainly points to the type of career you can expect from Ted Cruz. I wish I could say I was surprised, Ian, but I'm not. In the time that Ted Cruz has been involved in public life, he has been very nasty, very divisive. Remember, this is the young attorney who argued before the Supreme Court in favor of Tom DeLay's redistricting plan, which discriminated against African Americans and Hispanics across the state of Texas. And he's the mistake that can be made with Ted Cruz, though, is to assume that he's doltish or that he's not calculating in everything he does. I mean, whereas Joe McCarthy was, again, someone who was somewhat out of control and somebody who was not intellectual, Ted Cruz is very, very smart. He is somebody who knows exactly what he's doing. I compare him more to Nixon, quite frankly, who during the 50s did a lot of red baiting and drew attention to himself by making unfair accusations about communism, but did so in a calculated way in order to advance himself and to draw attention to himself. That's what you see with Ted Cruz, and I think we're going to see much more of it as time goes forward.
So I guess your point's well taken, Matt Engel, that Senator McCarthy was an out-of-control alcoholic, he wasn't too bright. Although he did capture the nation's attention, he terrorized thousands of people, destroyed the careers of hundreds of people, was genuinely, and even the president at the time, Eisenhower, seemed to be cowered into not really taking him on until finally CBS News, I think, in many ways, a lawyer for the Army finally brought him down. But it took a long time. So what's the theory with this guy then? He's smart. He's cynical, obviously, because he can't believe the nonsense that he spouts at these hearings. What's going to take him down?
Well, I think ultimately, to tell you the truth, time and demographics take him down. He's playing a very short-term game here. Remember, he's somebody of Hispanic descent, Latino descent, who got nominated in a Republican primary in Texas. That's very unusual. The Tea Party wing of the Republican Party in Texas almost always votes against Hispanic candidates within their own party. And he barely got into the runoff in order to get himself nominated. And so what he's doing now is really trying to earn his stripes among the most extreme and mean-spirited and narrow-minded elements within the Republican Party in Texas so that they don't for an instant thinks that his Latino heritage is some reason to instinctively vote against him, which is normally what they would do. And so I think what he's doing now is he is basically trying to separate himself, make himself the most extreme and polarizing figure in order to gain the favor of the majority of Texas primary voters, and he doesn't really care about what the institutional thinkers in Washington believe. He doesn't really care about the long-term good of his party or, quite frankly, the country. This is about advancing himself politically.
Well, he's sort of a Latino, but he was born in Canada. He doesn't speak Spanish. And in many ways, as much as you're saying to us that he was, he's sort of little defensive about being Latino. On the other hand, a lot of people a lot of people in the Republican Party and in Texas Republican politics were celebrating the fact that he was a Latino.
Oh, they're just doing that for, quite frankly, for the consumption of the media. The Republican Party in Texas doesn't even try very hard to gain broad Latino support. There's not a single Republican Hispanic elected official in Texas, and there are a few of them, but all of them lost the majority of the Hispanic vote. Every Latino Texan that you see got elected by the same Anglo right-wing Republican voters that vote for the Anglos. That's basically, when you see Republicans in Texas talking about reaching out to the Latino community, that's basically just window dressing. When they're really campaigning, when they're on the trail talking to their base, they don't talk about reaching out to Latino voters.
So this is really is extraordinary that this man is just being out of control, nasty, aggressive, resorting to these McCarthy-like tactics, saying that Chuck Hagel's lecture fees were paid by North Korea. I mean, he could have said they were paid by Martians, for all that matter. I mean, it just he's just making stuff up.
You're right. He is nasty and extreme, but he's not out of control. It's absolutely calculated. He knows the level of unfairness and an irresponsibility that the charges are, but he also knows that it draws attention to himself, and to the degree to which people in the media criticize him, that separates him out and actually advances him in the eyes of the extreme Tea Party Republicans who control the Republican primary vote in Texas.
So, in other words, the liberal media is falling into the trap. They're doing exactly what Ted Cruz wants.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm trying very hard to make sure that people know that this is all calculated by Ted Cruz to separate himself out, and to protect and insulate himself from any type of primary challenge going forward. Now, make no mistake, he is an extreme right-winger. He's somebody who takes the states' rights point of view on virtually everything and proposes the whole 10th Amendment theory that the states' primacy on virtually every issue. But this whole episode around Hagel and some of the other comments he's made early on is really about his self-preservation and his self-advancement.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. He has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. And we're talking about the 42-year-old Ted Cruz, a freshman senator from Texas, who distinguished himself in the hearings for Chuck Hagel to become the next Secretary of Defense, which, I don't know whether can you credit Ted Cruz with essentially holding up this to the point where there could even be a filibuster? I mean,
I don't want to give him that much credit. I think that Mitch McConnell and the Senate leadership, they wanted to clog up the works here. They wanted to do whatever they can to frustrate President Obama, and that Ted Cruz was willing to step up and play part of that role. But I'm not going to give Ted Cruz credit for that. I think that Mitch McConnell, if he wanted that vote to go forward, it would have gone forward.
So what did you make of Senator McCain's rebuke of Ted Cruz, where he said, all I can say is that it's appropriate that the appropriate way to treat Senator Hagel is to be as tough as you want to be, but don't be disrespectful or malign his character?
Well, while Senator McCain takes many positions I disagree with, I think he's a man of conscience, and he is a war hero. And he saw that Chuck Hagel is also a war hero who's put on the uniform, fought for our country, taking an enemy fire, been wounded. Whereas you've got Ted Cruz, who the most danger he's ever been is somebody in the courtroom being mad enough to take a swing at him. And so I think that McCain realized that what Senator Cruz was doing was shameful. I think it was dishonorable to our country and to our flag to attack Senator Hagel the way he did. And so I give Senator McCain credit for speaking out.
So when you said that this is a short-term game that, Cruz may not see it as a short-term game. He's obviously trying to shore up his Tea Party credentials, although he's in there for 6 years, so he's got quite a bit of time. How quickly are the demographics going to change, though, do you think, in Texas? Because
It certainly is changing rapidly, and the demographics, quite frankly, are ahead of the politics. In many places in Texas, the demographics are already in place to win local races and county races. We're not quite there because you don't yet have the investment in Texas. While there are a lot of Democrats with money in Texas, the state is so big that we really haven't had the investment that we need. And you hate to be so crass to say it's all about money, but the truth of the matter is some of the best campaigns that Democrats run are run in Texas, but we just haven't had the resources to do it statewide. And so I think in a matter of 2 or 4 years that the demographics will be in place. The real question is whether or not the political structures and the financing is in place.
So the fact that Cruz was among 22 senators who voted against reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, and one of 34 who voted against raising the debt ceiling, and one of 36 who opposed the relief package for the states hit by Hurricane Sandy. And he was only one of 3 senators who voted against John Kerry's confirmation. Do you think those votes are going to come back to haunt him in the next few years?
They certainly could. Those are votes that he may hear about and think about and regret in 6 years. And certainly he forced his senior Texas colleague, John Cornyn, to basically take those votes too. And Cornyn, because he is scared to death of a Tea Party challenge in a primary in Texas, took those votes. And I think Cornyn's going to regret those votes sooner rather than later. I think Cornyn will hear about them in the fall of 2014. Whether it's enough to cause him to lose, I don't know. But again, it shows that the actions that Cruz is taking, while they might be short-sighted and advance his career, they're not good for the Republican Party, not in Texas and certainly not nationally.
So I guess, well, I think we've run out of time here, Matt, but I'm in shock. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And the guy even looks like Joe McCarthy. It's a sad day for American politics that there are so many people out there that support this kind of candidate. I mean, he's not.
Ian, I know it sounds strange, but I'm glad that he did it early because that's the type of person he is. He's kind of put everybody on notice, and we need to take notice because he's somebody who could be very dangerous, much like Nixon. If we'd have known about Nixon 20 years before, we might not have suffered through what we did because of his actions.
Well, thank you for joining us, Matt Engel.
Again, thank you, Ian.
Again, Matt Engel directs the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. He served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Republicans' efforts to block a law that would stop European white Americans from going onto Indian land, raping and murdering Indian women and getting away with it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Deer, who's a professor at the William Mitchell College of Law and a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Sarah Deer is an expert on violence against Native women and has testified before Congress several times on the subject. She is co-author of The Gardens of Truth, The Prostitution and Sex Trafficking of Native Women in Minnesota, and is also an Amnesty International's Native American and Alaska Native Advisory Council member. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Deer.
Thank you.
I take it the work you did with Amnesty International first brought to everybody's attention this scourge of rape and violence against Native women
on tribal lands perpetrated by non-natives. So tell me about how you brought this story to the fore.
Well, we were the federal government actually released some data back in 1999, which confirmed what a lot of Indian people knew anecdotally, which is that the rates of crime were really out of control. And so in 2005, I connected with Amnesty International. They were interested in framing that issue as a human rights problem. And so I worked with Amnesty over the course of a couple of years to sort of capture the intensity of the problem, the depth of the problem. And we traveled to several reservations and Native villages to document with both, you know, research and photography the nature of the problem.
Well, what's extraordinary about it is that, first of all, in the Senate, there were 22 United States senators who voted against reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. It passed 78-22. And as you know, it's now before the House, and there's even more resistance to it in the House. And they seem to be taking the side, at least these House Tea Party types, are taking the side of the abusers of women. I mean, that's how it looks.
It certainly does. The objections that they are raising to the legislation, they raise this constitutional argument. And I'm a Native professor, but I also teach constitutional law. And so I'm trying to figure out what their constitutional objections are, and I haven't found anything that seems like a true constitutional objection. So sort of left to wonder what their true motives are. I've heard them call this a tribal power grab. Certainly tribes are not going to get any more power. They're going to have to pay to prosecute non-Indians. But the objection seems to be about a distrust at some level of tribal governments. And I'm not sure where that comes from.
But let's just explain. I think we got a little ahead of ourselves here, Sarah, in as much as this ridiculous prosecutorial loophole allows essentially white men or non-natives who are responsible for 86% of the rapes on tribal lands involving Indian women, they essentially get off scot-free. That's the loophole, right? So that's the status quo. And that's if that's what these Republicans are defending, that's what they're defending.
It does definitely seem that way. Yes, tribal governments lack criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, which means that if a non-Indian comes into the tribal community and commits an act of domestic violence, an act of rape, an act of homicide even, there's absolutely nothing that the tribe can do to hold that person accountable. Now, technically, there is an option for the federal government in most cases, and in some cases, depending on the tribe, it's the state government, to come in and prosecute those crimes. But what we found is that it rarely ever happens, which means that no one prosecutes that offender. And sometimes the tribal police can't even make an arrest.
Well, some of the arguments that have been offered by those that are opposing the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, particularly from the Tea Party Caucus, from Freedom Works, for example, are just quoting their statement. A man that raises his voice at his partner, calls her an offensive name, stalks her, causes her any emotional distress, or simply just annoys her, can potentially be prosecuted under the Violence Against Women's Act. Calling your spouse a mean name is not advised or polite, but it isn't the same thing as violence towards her. Now, that seems like a piece of mental gymnastics to downplay the seriousness of this issue, surely.
Right. And I think they're actually wrong on that. I think for most state and federal prosecutions, there certainly has to be some sort of physical element, you know, some slap or push or something, you know, that is physical. But what we tell the courts and what the courts are doing is not just looking at that particular act of violence, but all of the behavior that comes before and after the violence, which does include severe emotional harassment and name calling, that all becomes part of a pattern of abuse. So you wouldn't prosecute someone for simply saying, you know, I'm mad at you and I think you're, you know, a bad word. But it would have to be part of a larger pattern, which includes violence. And that's the piece I think they're being disingenuous about.
Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Deer, who is a professor at William Mitchell College of Law and a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. She's an expert on violence against Native women and has testified before Congress several times. And she's the co-author of Garden of Truth, The Prostitution and Sex Trafficking of Native Women in Minnesota, and is also an Amnesty International Native American and Alaska Native Advisory Council member. And just to get some history on the Violence Against Women Act, Women's Act, which was passed in 1994, it has really been incredibly successful. It has reduced the overall intimate partner violence in the United States, since most of the violence is between people who live together, either as husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend, whatever. It has declined 64% since it's been enacted in 1994. And from 1994 to 2010, about 4 in 5 victims of intimate partner violence were female. Females ranging from 18 to 34 generally experience the highest rate of intimate partner violence. So those are the facts, that it, one, the women are the victims, and mostly younger women, and two, since the act has been put into place, the violence against women has declined 64%. So instead of holding this thing up, shouldn't we be celebrating it?
Absolutely. It's just been the most interesting piece of legislation that has created so many good results, not just in the declination of domestic violence, which in and of itself would be, you know, a wonderful result, but it also has created shelter programs in rural communities where women had really literally nowhere to go if they were afraid in their home. And so the development of these shelters all across the country has really been a life saving development. And were the Violence Against Women Act not reauthorized this year, many of those shelter programs will have to shut their doors.
So I'm somewhat confused here about the mixed message that we're hearing from the Republican House and particularly the Tea Party caucus. You recall recently, Sarah, the testimony in the House after the massacre in Newtown, when they were forced into having a hearing. And of course, the House, since it's controlled by the Republicans, were able to put up their witnesses in this hearing on gun control. So you had this pro-NRA woman on, whose name I can't quite remember now, but she was making the most amazing hyperbolic cases why women needed guns, and particularly needed assault rifles in their own home.
Right, I do remember that.
You remember that? And she said, yeah, you know, and 5 guys come in and try to rape you, and you got this big, nasty-looking gun, and that scares them off. And they're putting forth this ludicrous idea. But they were really stressing, the Republicans on the congressional panel, were stressing the vulnerability of women and how we've got to give them guns so that they can level the playing field. So here they are inventing needs for women to have guns. At the same time, when you have manifest evidence that women are being raped on tribal land, mostly by white men who get off scot-free, they have no interest in that, stopping that violence against women, which is real, as opposed to this mythical idea that women in their homes need assault rifles because there are these roaming bands of men that come in and rape you in your kitchen.
Yeah, and it really goes back to the myth, I think, that a lot of people who are just not informed have about violence against women, which is that it is the stranger breaking into your home or the stranger jumping out of the bushes. And in reality, the most dangerous place to be a woman in the United States is in your home. And your perpetrator is more likely than not to be someone that you love or someone who purports to love you. So guns don't help in those situations. And I think most women who have small children, if they are afraid of their spouse, the last thing they want in their home is a gun, because the likelihood that they'll be killed with it or their children will be accidentally killed with it far outweighs any chance they would have to, you know, ward off a stranger.
So what's your sense then of what's going to happen this week in the House in terms of the debate following the Senate reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act by a vote of 78 to 22? And of course, Marco Rubio, the rising star of the Republican Party, voted against the reauthorization, as did Ted Cruz, the sort of reincarnation of Joe McCarthy, the firebrand Tea Party senator from Texas, the freshman.
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm trying to remain optimistic because I've been working on this legislation for well over 2 years. And so I try to keep an optimistic perspective on it. But I think what's going to be key if we're going to see this move forward in the House is to educate many of these Republicans as to the reality in Indian country. For example, Eric Cantor, who has a lot of power in determining what happens next, comes from a state, Virginia, where there's no Indian tribes. And so if his experience is, you know, probably based in one of, you know, myths or stereotypes, or he's just not experienced tribal courts before. So he has a perspective that maybe isn't connected to the reality. And so it's a matter of getting to D.C. and making sure Native women can communicate directly with these Republicans, because that's really the only chance that we have is if we can convince more of those folks to vote in favor of Native women. And it's going to be a long haul, but I'm trying to remain optimistic.
I think, though, didn't Eric Cantor sort of make some noises on the House floor that he supported the Violence Against Women Act?
Yes, he did, but he did condition that. He said he had concerns about the piece of the, you know, the portion of the legislation that deals with tribal courts. He wasn't specific about what his concerns are, so we're sort of left to wonder, you know, what his objection is. But he did say that he did care about what happened to Native women. So I'm looking forward to seeing him follow through on those words.
But Sarah Deer, again, professor at the William Mitchell College of Law and citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. She's an expert on violence against Native women and has testified before Congress several times on the subject and co-authored The Gardens of Truth, The Prostitution and Sex Trafficking of Native Women in Minnesota. Still, when they make these arguments about this ridiculous loophole, this prosecutorial loophole that allows non-Native men to go into tribal lands, rape women, even murder them and get away scot-free because the tribal courts don't have jurisdiction, the idea that you would give these tribal courts jurisdiction is somehow being objected to. What is the basis in terms of law, since you're a law professor? I mean, why would a rapist of women who now gets away with it scot-free, I can't stress that often enough, what kind of legal jeopardy would these courts put them in? What is their legal objection to giving these courts the ability to do what all courts in the nation do, which is to prosecute people for crimes when there's manifest evidence against them?
Well, you know, their legal arguments, they raise the term. They will say the word constitutional, but they haven't really explained what the analysis is beyond that. And I think it's sort of a code word, you know, for we don't like the legislation. You know, if you can say it's unconstitutional, that sounds a lot better than just saying oh, we don't like it. But they seem to be concerned about the defendant's rights in tribal court, which is interesting because I think a lot of these folks don't really concern themselves with civil rights in other contexts. But they seem to be concerned that a white man or any non-Native man who's prosecuted in tribal court will not get constitutional rights, like the right to confront witnesses, the right, you know, the protection against double jeopardy, those kinds of rights. And so they're raising that and saying we can't let these men, you know, go into a courtroom and not have those rights protected. But the funny thing is, they already do have those rights protected. We have something called the Indian Civil Rights Act, which is a statute which requires tribal governments to give defendants every right that's in the American Constitution. So that's why I find it very puzzling that their objection continues to be about the, you know, the rights of the defendant, when the rights of the defendant are clearly protected under the law.
So this seems to be playing into the growing perception that the Republican Party is conducting a war on women. And my understanding is that I'm not entirely sure that after this last election, where the Republicans did very poorly in terms of votes from women and minorities, and now they recognize they have a demographic time bomb ticking, whether or not they've really had their come to Jesus moment or whether indeed they see it as a public relations problem, you know, irrespective of what the real motives are. What's your understanding then of the argument? I mean, I'm hearing these arguments from the Karl Roves and the Bobby Jindals, you know, saying we're in danger of being the stupid party. Do you detect that that's going on? In other words, maybe they'll vote for the Violence Against Women Act, not because they think it's the right thing to do, but because they think it's the right thing to do in terms of electoral politics.
I think either way, Native women will come out on top, because what we just need, and it doesn't really matter what party it comes from, we need relief. We need to know that when we are attacked in our own communities, in our own homes, that somebody will come and take action. I do think that the GOP has an image problem, and I do think that they're backtracking a little bit on their anti-women legislation. But when, you know, some of these representatives refuse to even meet with Native women, won't even return phone calls to Native women, we are really left to wonder what their motives are and whether they really do care, or they're just covering for bad, you know, like you said, bad press, bad PR. But we're going to keep fighting. I mean, we're not going to just lay down and roll over. And if we have to convince some Tea Party Republicans to vote in our favor, we'll do that. But it's going to be a long learning curve, again, for a lot of these men who really don't know what a tribal court is. And it starts, like, with that basic piece of education.
Just in closing, though, Sarah dear, the education that you provided is shocking enough, surely, that men, largely white men, are free to go onto Native lands and rape and even murder Native American women with impunity, and they get away with it. And that's the law of the land. And you're trying to change that law of the land. I mean, this goes back to sort of, to my mind, it's unearthing the horrible history of the way Native Americans have been treated in this country. That if you're a Native American woman, your basic rights don't exist.
Exactly. And that's why it's so frustrating when the focus seems to be on defendant rights, especially from a party who doesn't seem too concerned about the rights of people who are defendants in state or federal courts. And there's certainly been a lot of press about the kind of constitutional challenges that states engage in, you know, like the New York City stop and frisk policies, which raise all kinds of constitutional questions. You don't see these same Tea Party Republicans, you know, raising any concerns about those defendants' rights. So it seems like a double standard when it comes to tribal courts. And it sends a message to Native women that we have heard for centuries, which is that your lives are not important. So we're sort of used to that at some level, but it is outrageous, and that's why, you know, I don't think we're going to take no for an answer this time.
Well, Sarah Deer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Deer, who's a professor at the William Mitchell College of Law and citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Sarah Deer is an expert on violence against Native women. She's testified before the Congress several times on the subject and is the co-author of Gardens of Truth, The Prostitution and Sex Trafficking of Native Women in Minnesota. She's also Amnesty International's Native American and Alaska Native Advisory Council member. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again on Monday at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.